Tonight, I'm going to share with you the research in Clear Choices for Churches, Trends Among Growing and Declining Churches of Christ. Anyone had a chance to read this at this point? Okay, good, good. Well, I'll reinforce a little bit of what you read, and maybe I'll shed some light on some perspectives that you may or may not have thought about. As an intro, let me just share with you two areas about this book. I want to share with you first the value I see in the book, and also the good news I think the book offers. Are you folks busy with a lot of things to do? You've got a lot of things to accomplish in ministry. Now, I'm sure you've heard of the Pareto Principle. There was an Italian economist called Alfredo Pareto. And he basically observed that 20% of all of our efforts really produces 80% of the results. And if you can identify that 20% and put most of your energy there, that's where you're going to get the greatest results. Well, what I hope to share with you in the value of this book, it's a study of what is contributing to growth and decline in churches of Christ. And so, I'm going to share with you the major areas of ministry that would be worth you identifying as the top 20% to put your greatest effort in that will produce 80% of the results. So, do you think that that could be of value? I hope so. I can't imagine any other piece of valuable information to a person who is concerned about the ministry life of their church. And then the good news I want to share with you, any church that wants to grow today can grow. I don't care what you've heard in the past, we are not at the mercy of our contextual conditions, that's our surrounding conditions. We can choose. The good news is the research is verifying this in greater number. And that's why I titled this, Clear Choices for Churches, Trends Among Growing and Declining Churches of Christ. If you will plant and water effectively, I want you to know God is giving the increase. And not only that, if there is any congregation in your community growing, you can grow as well. Because it's the methods that you choose will make the difference of whether you're growing or not. Let me give you a brief description. Just bear with me. I'll go through this quickly, but I don't want to overstate what I'm offering to you in this study. I want you to understand where it comes from, because one of the aspects of it is it offers some objective evaluation of the 20% that produces 80% of the results. And it's based on a study of churches over about an 8-year period that I conducted diagnostic evaluations. Now, these are churches that took 3 months to get ready for me to come and supplied me with an intense amount of very in-depth data. And I'm going to tell you, there is no researcher in the social science fields or any other fields that can collect this kind of data. Churches won't give it to them because they don't feel like they're going to get anything out of it. Most researchers will only send out a few pages, and they'll hope one person will fill out, you know, the information on these pages. It's helpful, but it is not in depth, and it's not as deep of quality as we get in these diagnostic evaluations. The downside of it is we can't possibly match the sample size that social scientists get, but yet we get depth and quality in the data. You have to understand that it's what we call a convenient sample. And it's important for you to realize this, because if you were to extrapolate this research to every Church of Christ, it would have to be a true random sample, and it's not. You have to have some match to the sample itself to be able to draw the application. So let me give you where the sample comes from. It is not a Bible Belt study. It represents 14 states and 2 Canadian provinces, and it's from coast to coast. But it is primarily suburban urban churches, not inner city churches. They will have some dynamics basically not in the urban suburban churches. They are basically traditional churches. There are no innovative models. There were no churches dominated by campus ministry or dominated by a retirement community. So we're talking about probably the most typical type of church, and they're established churches. They were not new plants, because a new church plant has a dynamic of its own. The median age was 46 years. The study sample was 34 churches and involved 6,771 members. These 6,771 members filled out 10-page surveys asking them to value every dimension of church life. And then the office filled out a stack of surveys on everything imaginable. I mean, we looked at staffing, we looked at programming, we looked at facilities, we looked at finances, we looked at the community demographics. All of these things were looked at. About half of the sample was growing, half of the sample was declining. Out of all of the variables, there were 189 of them, we applied what's called Pearson correlations to those variables to see if they had any kind of statistical relationship between growing and declining churches. Well, out of the 189 variables, 42 was statistically significant. That is, there was some relationship that was not just an accidental relationship. 42. Then what we did is took the 42 and put them in three different clusters. That is, what a church does, its ministry activities. That's called institutional variables. Then we looked at the congregational characteristics. And then we looked at the contextual variables. That's the community. And ran multiple regression analysis on that. Now here's what multiple regression analysis will do for you. It'll tell you of the cluster of variables, which is the most important. And they're listed in the actual priority of importance. What a church does, the institutional variables, turned out to be the most important predictor of growth and decline. And there were four variables that proved to be very significant. And what it will also do is it'll tell you what is the most important. It'll prioritize the ones that will hold up. Some variables that were significant wash out under controls of this nature, and what will really hold up. So I want you to basically understand that I let the data say, okay, this is what's important, and then as we try to explore and find out what the relationships are, you have to use your own judgment and intuition and knowledge. So, before I get into the four most important variables that was discovered, I found one factor that ran through all four. And I introduced it to the folks that were here last night, and it was this. Growing churches are reaching young adults. That's absolutely, critical, because it correlated to every growth variable. And it will help you understand if you're going to interpret it. When you do cross correlations, you can find what relates to another area. If you're going to understand the four areas, you've got to understand that they relate to reaching young adults, 20 to 39, and often have preteens. And we'll get to that in just a minute. But the real challenge that we're facing, and I will not have time to go into this in depth, but in Clear Choices, I deal with this in Chapter 1 called The Generation Gulf. Folks, the values that were produced pre-World War II and the values that were produced post-World War II are so different, they are literally causing tremendous conflict in churches. Now, notice I didn't say people, raised pre-war, post-war. I said values. Now, it will relate to age in most cases, but what you will find is sometimes folks will cross over. Older folks will have post-war values, and some young folks will have pre-war values. Does that make sense? Have I lost you at all on that? Okay. Please don't mind stopping me. I mentioned to the other group, communication is important. And we're going to cover a lot. We'll cover it fast. And if I just miss you, believe me, if you're not catching something, I'm not communicating it well, and probably someone else is not. So please stop me and ask me to clarify. I don't mind. Okay? Everybody agree with that? And if you'll nod with me every now and then, I'll know that you're awake this time of night. And that'd be important too. All right? Folks, when I go into churches and get to see on the inside what's going on, let me tell you what the four grassroots issues, real quick. Here are the four conflict issues. I'm not going to be able to go into depth. But number one is worship styles. That is the most consistent conflict issue. Will we do the traditional style, or will we consider some sort of contemporary style? And those are usually pre-war, post-war value preferences. In other words, we prefer one over the other. The second one is leadership decision-making styles. Will we follow the old closed, authoritative boardroom style that kind of worked and was accepted when we respected authority? Or on the other hand, will we use participatory style with a very educated congregation wanting to have a chance to have some say in the direction of the church? Number two, that's participatory versus the closed boardroom style. Number three, believe it or not, small home groups. Is this some sort of faddish ministry moving us away from time-honored ministry that we normally have done Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday? Or is this a biblical style of ministry meeting some very important needs that we see in society? And the last one is time management, which ties right in with small groups and other kind of ministries. Look, we've always met at the building Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night. And if you do anything different, you got to do it another night of the week. Or will we use Sunday night and Wednesday night for other ministries that seem to have a greater significance to the life of the members rather than just the typical building kind of activities? Those are the four that I run into over and over and over. Now, you got to recognize, I'm not being invited into too many churches that are at the point of conflict that they need a third-party conflict resolutionist. But I go in sometimes to congregations that are so conflicted, they're right next to exploding. And these are still the issues. It's not women's role. It's not identity problems. It's not all of these other issues that we hear a lot about. Those are not major issues right now in Churches of Christ. They're there, but they have not surfaced enough to be major. Everybody with me on that when I say, I'm not saying they're not problems. I'm just saying they are really not what is really causing some intention in churches. Let me show you the other aspect of this thing that's a real challenge. When you look at American births from 1910 to the present, notice this is the pre-war generation. Those born before World War II, you'll notice it ranges anywhere from close to 2.5 million to 3 million births per year. But now, the gulf that I'm talking about begins about 1945, 46, and this is the baby boom generation. And that term is not just a title, it's a description. Can you see the boom and the blast off almost coming up to 4.5 million births per year? Now, here's what is happening. These folks, for the most part, are living longer. And in many cases are in positions of authority in the church. And in many cases do not understand the differences between the pre and the post-war. Now along comes the boomers, and they're getting to the age where they're moving into leadership roles and are wanting some consideration for needs that are beyond the traditional. And that creates those four problems that we've talked about. But the bottom line is, growing churches are taking the time to reach young adults. I introduced the demographic breakdown last night. Do you recall that? If you were here, I said, this is on average what a growing Church of Christ looks like demographically and a declining Church of Christ in these particular age categories. The best way to look at it, as I adjust these figures, is basically growing churches have a balance. A third young folks, third young adults, and a third older folks. Where declining churches basically have made the choices. They have made the choices, and I'm going to talk about the four areas. They made choices in those four areas that have caused the 20s and 30s to leave, and they leave taking their preteen kids. Bottom line. Okay, so we wanted to lay that down, but I also want it to be very visual. I want to show you a picture. And it's a composite type picture of the most frequent new member among Churches of Christ. Now, the only thing I want to clarify, I apologize that I did not find a picture to express diversity. You need to add ethnic diversity, and then you've got an accurate picture. But I wanted you to see this age-wise. If you would put together a composite picture of the most frequent new member in Churches of Christ, they are 20 to 39, married, and they have two kids between the ages of 6 and 11. Those people are showing up most often. If a church cannot reach those people, it's not likely to reach any. And so as we deal with this, I want you to keep that in mind. I want to ask real quick, but before we go, do churches have a choice of whether they reach these people or not? Absolutely. Let me give you the evidence. Because I look at churches, if I can get the data, say, 10 years earlier and look at the present, I put together a composite picture of several declining churches. Now, they were declining in 1990, but not in 1980. Now, this is not one church, there's several. I didn't want anybody's specific data to be shown. Notice, this church in 1980 is fairly balanced. Do you see that? Within the reasonable range of what we said. 10 years later, they're imbalanced. Now, I've gone into these churches, I've studied these churches, I know these churches, and I want to tell you, they became imbalanced because of the choices they made, not because they were somehow or another affected by their communities. Let me give you the consequence. By the way, the most sensitive age group of all to tell you if your church has growth potential is this age group right there. Anybody want to guess? Maybe help me out if my picture's accurate or not. I got to change the picture for sure. That's supposed to be the 20 to 29-year-olds. So I'll work on it. I'll work on my pictures, all right? Folks, the litmus test of a church's ability to grow is their ability to keep and attract 20-year-olds. I mentioned this to a brother. Now, he worked with singles and with young adults. He says, well, John, now, wait a minute. I want to clarify something with you. You said it's the litmus test, right? He said, do you mean, is that like, you know, years ago where they'd put this canary in this cage and they would lower the bird down in the mine shaft? And if the bird croaked, they knew that the air was basically bad with gas and so forth? And I said, well, I guess that'd be okay. That'd be a good way to look at it. Yes, that's right. If there are no 20 to 29-year-olds, the atmosphere is bad. And they're gone. That's the key. And the consequences of when you lose these people in your church, here's what members tell me in those 10-page surveys. Our morale is low. We're not a friendly church. We don't look forward to the assemblies. And on I could go. That's what they say. Even though they don't realize that they are making a contribution to running these people off in the first place. And when these people are there, you find vitality, you find outreach, and you generally find growth. So now that you know this one theme that ran through all the variables, we're ready to get started. We'll walk through them. Here are the four variables under the institutional area of what churches choose to do. And again, I want you to realize I didn't select these. I let the data come up. And then certainly we know a lot about these areas because they're always are important. The top of the list was the worship assembly. But let me clarify the actual way that it surfaced. It was the assembly's ability to attract new members. There were a number of questions asking people, are you happy? Are you satisfied with worship? Questions like, look forward to the morning worship assembly. Satisfied with morning worship assembly. The church is warm and friendly. Satisfied with the singing, and so forth. Those were important in relating to growth, but they washed out under rigorous analysis. The only thing that held up was the assembly's ability to attract new people, and would you like to guess what age range? 20 to 40 or 20 to 39, exactly. But I would offer this warning without a shadow of a doubt. Worship is the most sensitive conflict area in churches, and it's not just Churches of Christ, by the way. It's churches across the board. And part of the reason is we have done our worship the same way for so long. We have theologized our methods. That is, this must be the only biblically right way to do it. And so people have literally theologized those methods, and they find a great deal of satisfaction in going through those particular forms, never realizing that they are tradition. I forgot to bring a little cartoon. It's so great. I found it in Leadership Journal, and I'll describe it to you. There's this guy. He's up on up on this platform, and he's being taken to the gallows. And you can see the ropes hanging. And there's two guys talking at the bottom, and they said, "We tried to tell him not to change the order of service." It can be that serious. I'm telling you, just go in your church and switch the communion opposite, either before or after the sermon, and watch the reaction. Violent reaction of people. So I just tell you that to tell you, even though this is the most important area, it still is the area you better walk lightly for your own sake. I love you in the Lord, and I want you to minister for a long time. And so you need to be aware of it. It needs a lot of preparation. Here are the areas that need improvement, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on worship because, I mean, there's, you know, everybody is... There's numerous sessions out here on worship. Have any of you been on worship yet? Been on any of the sessions? Okay. So I'm just going to tell you, the atmosphere, we will talk about that a little bit later. The atmosphere must change, not only in worship, but throughout our churches. We'll talk about that a little bit later. The music, we must improve the music, and we must improve the message. And it's high time we got away from song leaders and moved to worship leaders. That is a person who will spend a week planning and developing the highest level of worship imaginable. Listen, a preacher will put 10 to 15 hours into getting his messages ready for Sunday, and I have watched churches put together the rest of the worship service in 10 to 15 minutes before the service begins. Haven't you seen it? It's because we've taken such an amateurish view of worship, and that is, it ought to be everybody's thing, and so we just let everybody have their turn. But I'm going to tell you, Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 14, worship ought to be done unto edification. That's building us up. And that takes time and training and practice and planning. Planning themes. Helping people understand transitions. Killing and removing dead time. And having a message that lifts hearts so when they leave there, they're excited about being Christians. A lot needs to be done, but that's all I'm going to say about worship. But worship at the top of the list, and worship that attracts new members. Why praise teams? Praise teams are very, very effective in helping a church transition to contemporary scene. Here's the reason I'm finding praise teams to be so absolutely helpful. Members are not as comfortable as you are transitioning into newer songs. So a quality praise team enables a church to still maintain a high quality song service because the praise team will carry the congregational singing until the members master the songs. Does that make sense? I see praise teams more as a tool to help a congregation move into a more contemporary style of worship in terms of music. Did that help at all? That seems to be the value. Let me tell you, I said I wasn't going to spend a whole lot of time here, but just a few weeks ago, I went into a black congregation in Oklahoma. Folks, I sat through a 2-hour and 45-minute worship service, and I didn't even think to look at my watch to 2.5 hours. These brethren had the most fabulous worship I have ever experienced in my life. The singing was so fabulous. When the folks tapped their feet to the beat of the music, the floors vibrated.
Yeah.
No, it was absolutely fabulous. In that, it enabled my spirit to feel a sense of praise. Here is what is happening in this country. America has basically become, rather than so much cognitive, they are more emotive. That is, when you look at media, like movies and music and all of these other cultural changes, have brought in the need to experience what we do rather than just rationally understand what we do. People want to experience worship. They want to be helped to be brought into the presence of God. And this is not something you just think about. I listened to a restoration presentation about Alexander Campbell, and I found myself so alienated from Alexander Campbell. I was amazed. Because I'm really a left-brain person. But getting into worship and experiencing the right brain expression of worship is such a joy. And let me tell you, young people, if you can't touch the right brain of young people, you will not catch them because they want to experience things. Because they experience everything else they want to experience. Yes, there's a time to touch the left brain. There's the time for instruction. But I'm talking about worship ought to be something that is not only just experienced mentally, cognitively. It ought to be something experienced emotionally. Anyway, I didn't want to spend too much time, but I appreciate your comment. It's great. Yes.
I teach at a denominational college.
Yes.
Very fine people, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Their greatest concern at the moment is they have gone so much to the emotive, and they have their drums, and they have all this sort of thing, and they get them excited that they cannot pull them back to the other brain.
Well, let me tell you what, I've seen otherwise.
Yeah.
I went to the Northeast congregation. Arneas Crenshaw is the minister. And in every way, it was an African-American style, and I'm telling you, that message had more meaning to it than any message. I can tell you now, and you think back, how many messages can you remember that you heard? I know the problem, but what I'm saying is that's not necessarily a natural consequence. I think there's a balance here that we've missed. That's all I'm trying to say. But I can tell you right now, his sermon was about deliverance. And I'll never forget it, because I'm telling you, it was given with passion as well as with rational intercourse.
Yeah,
we've done a lot of research on this, and UCLA folks kind of analyze it on emotions. But the reason you have poetry, singing, deep, is you increase your neurotransmitters.
Exactly.
And a flat lecture, less than 10%.
That's right.
You beef it up with feeling, you increase acetylcholine, you increase neurotransmitters.
Interesting.
You remember more of it.
Right.
That's the scientific part of the science.
Good. That's good. Well, see, you're never going to reach a left brain person until you bring that point in. That's why I like research, because I know research can have some impact on my left brain brethren. And certainly, as you know, I would have to be a left brain person to do this kind of work.
That way, video tape coming cold across the TV screen.
Yeah, I cannot. I tell people.
If we studied that one, then the learning is low. And if you put a person up there,
yes,
to talk it and have some feeling with it, mm-hmm, then you maybe get 20%.
Absolutely.
Less than 10% the other way.
I tell people over and over when I go in and work, and work with churches, I cannot describe to you contemporary worship. I cannot describe to you excellence in worship. It is not describable. It's something you experience.
That's why Psalms is written with poetic sound.
Right. And so not until you experience it. And I know they have opportunities to experience it here on campus, and that's where you need to go and experience it. But the problem is, you've got to get your leadership and your members to experience it in a non-threatening setting. That's the key. Problem is, our members are isolated and stuck in theologizing their methods and scared to death of anything different. Got to go. All right, number two. We could go all day. I appreciate it. Excellent stuff to get us a cat. Number two, proper staffing, folks. Listen, staffing is a precondition for growth. Having staffing does not guarantee growth, because you've got to have the staff and they've got to do the right things. But not having staff guarantees little to no growth. I want to go to the ratios that we found in the original study. Growing Churches of Christ had one full-time paid minister, and staff does not include secretaries, custodians, etc. That is support staff. I'm talking about paid ministers. One minister for every 125 members on average, and this took in some smaller churches, so you got to understand that. You had to factor that in a little bit, because it took in churches around just a couple in the 80-90 range, but majority of them were above 100, certainly. And we covered that last night in the 112 church study. Deaconing had one per 200, and probably a good balance is, if you really want to know the transition point that's easiest to see, for about when you reach 150 members, or rather, 150 in attendance, you should be planning for the second man. Even if it's a part-time person. Preferably a full-time person. Whenever you had a church that was adequately staffed, in almost every case, it would correlate to things like this. It correlated to the fact they would have 20 to 29-year-olds, the morale was high, they were warm and friendly in their atmosphere, they were open, accepting, and non-judgmental, they were evangelistic, and they had an adequate number of groups to assimilate people. Having the staff correlated to having all the variables you're going to see. In other words, they related to these other variables. But I want to share another finding that came up about staffing that is really, really significant. Because you've got to have the right attitude in your staff, and your staff must be doing the right things. We ask preachers to select the top five areas of responsibility that they felt was theirs from preaching, counseling, teaching, shepherding, creating atmosphere for growth, evangelism, benevolence, administration, community involvement, motivation, inspiration, visiting the homes and hospitals, equipping others for service, and providing leadership. Here is what we found that was very different between a growing church and a declining church with their ministers. I'm talking about their pulpit ministers. Pulpit ministers in growing churches of Christ considered leadership consistently third in their list of the five top responsibilities. In declining churches of Christ, it averaged seventh when we put them all together. What is happening? Let me tell you what's happening with the declining church and what's happening with the growing church. A minister of a declining church so often has a compartmentalized view of ministry. I'm hired to preach, I'm hired to teach, I'm hired to visit, I'm hired to do a little counseling, the rest of it's everybody else's business, I'm just staying out of the way. That's the words I've heard repeated. Oh, I just try to stay out of the way. That is a sure recipe for a non-growth environment. Because the preacher is a major catalyst for growth because of communication. You see, the cardiovascular system of a church is communication. You move in the direction of your most dominant thoughts. Tell me, where does most communication take place? Church is ever going to move toward growth dimensions in any kind, it doesn't matter in what. It must be consistently communicated from the pulpit, from the classrooms, from the bulletins, and of course, the pulpit is number one. So therefore, a pulpit minister is a major leader because of communication, because leadership is influence. And therefore, a growing church, a minister felt like he needed to be concerned with the health of the whole congregation rather than just a compartmentalized view of a few areas, and would take on the responsibility of trying to help the whole church have a sense of direction, know its purpose, understand its vision, and establish the kind of goals it takes to accomplish growth. But by the way, he did it in spite of the members and the elders. Members and elders also rank their preacher's responsibilities. And the members and elders all saw leadership as around ninth on average. And the reason I believe that's true, hang on just one second, the reason I believe that's true is because we equate leadership and authority, which they are not the same. We assume, and I'm not even going to get into theology here, but we assume that, okay, elders have the final say. That's authority. So therefore, they are then the leaders. But I'm going to tell you, that is destructive in the life of a church. Because I'm going to tell you, everyone is a leader somewhere in certain ways. A Bible school teacher is a leader. Because you define leadership simply in terms of influence. Are you influencing anyone in the kingdom? And again, the number one area of consistent influence is the pulpit. And the pulpit minister of growing churches will go ahead and exert influence as best he can, regardless of the attitude of the members and the elders. But I'm not saying at all that they are into adversarial relationships, because the saddest condition I ever find when I go into churches for analysis is when I see the elders and staff locked in adversarial relationships. Now, I want to stop because there's a question, and then I'll come back to that. Yes? Certainly. For the preacher. For the preachers. In other words, in most cases, they don't see providing leadership as the preacher's role. They have more of a hireling view of a preacher. We hire him to come in and preach us, you know, preach to us, teach to us, etc. There's one other area. Hang on, I'll try to get to it. But I want to show you. Whenever I find elders the preacher in particular, locked in adversarial relationships, I can tell you right off that church has almost zero growth potential. Only when I go in and I see the elders and the preacher building spiritual relationships, building a vision together, working together, do I see the kind of conditions that enables that church to grow. I found these little cartoons. It really expresses the sadly but truthfully what we see too often. See the fellow, the preacher says, "You know, I have a recurring dream in which I have the elders pleading for mercy, but when I wake up, I can never remember how." Sometimes it's the preacher's fault. You know, sometimes the preacher does not know how to be a team player with the elders. Sometimes it's the elders' fault. Here's the attitude of some elders. You see the two guys dueling? This may set an ugly precedent for the future board decisions. So you see these kind of situations, but I want to tell you right at the top, staff will only be effective if they are in a close spiritual relationship with the elders, because the elders are leaders and the preacher is a leader, the ministers are leaders, and they need to have the same understanding of their biblical purpose, the same understanding of their vision, and when one stands, you should feel totally confident that what that person says is supported by the rest of the group.
Yeah. What's your recommendation on order of staffing?
Order of staffing? You cannot give an absolute answer to that, because every situation will be somewhat different. For example, typically someone would say youth ministers, obviously what you'd connect. But I know some churches that have outstanding Lads to Leaders programs and Leaderette programs. And for them, a youth minister isn't necessarily what will fit their need. They may look at some other area, whether it be education, outreach, small group, whatever. So you have to take that case by case. But the additional staff is important. And there are a lot of reasons that I simply don't have time to go through. But The other area we found that growing churches had preachers that rated evangelism in their responsibility higher than a declining church. And that comes to our third area, and evangelism is it. Folks, I'm going to tell you something. This is baptism to member ratio. This came as a surprise to me. Now, you would think that's common sense. No, it's not. The conventional wisdom is, if you're sitting in the right location and you put on some good programs, you're going to be a growing church. But the research says that's not the case. And I wish you should have seen the research last night with the broader base study, including different sizes, and we saw the incredible reality that the larger the church, and especially when you get into huge churches, 700 and above, they're absolutely doing no evangelism whatsoever. But we're finding that growing churches, in the first study, this is what was found. And outside the huge churches, this pretty much holds up. Here's what it looks like. Growing churches are baptizing 7.1 individuals per 100 members annually, while declining only baptizes 3.7. When I first saw this, I thought, well, it's because they're baptizing members' children. But when you factor in this, 2.0 is children, 1.6, that's not significant in difference. What is significant is the 5.1 to 2.1. Growing churches are twice as evangelistic as declining churches. Is that clear? And I explained to you why most of our churches can't break out of the 1,000 barrier. And it has to do with this very item, and that is they have so many people in their face, they're spending all their time basically taking care of their own and don't have a vision for the mission God has called them to. They don't have a concern for the lost. And all of the mega churches in this country, if you will look at them, are mission-driven churches. They have a burning passion for the lost, even though they are having to also minister to the thousands that are in their face. They do it because they do not allow what their purpose is as a church to get lost. Declining churches tend to lose sight of that. 7.1 baptisms per 100. Per 100. Per year. Okay? So, a 100 member church would baptize 7 folks. A 200 member church would baptize 14 folks, roughly. Now, these are averages. We're seeing some real aggressive evangelistic churches, I mean, doubling and tripling these figures. And this is the average.
100 membership?
Yeah, 100 membership. I was just showing you how to work out. Now, there's some implications in this data you need to understand because it's going to be far-reaching for churches in the future. I'm telling you, this is significant. Because what we see in this is that the numbers alone does not account for the growth, the additional increase that you see in the growing church compared to the declining church. Did you catch that? In other words, if you just took the additional numbers from the baptisms, that would not account for the actual greater increase in number. Well, something else is going on here. And what else is going on is, and this will tie right into the 1,000 barrier and why we can't build mega churches. Every church has a personality. And we're going to deal with this tomorrow as we look at spiritual renewal. And a growing church that's evangelistic has an extroverted personality. And not only are they outgoing and warm and kind to the unchurched, they're outgoing, warm, and kind to the visitor that's looking for a church home. Where the introverted church is the non-growing church, they're looking inward, and they never take the time to even warm up to the people who show up looking for a church home. So it's the evangelistic churches that are not only reaching more souls evangelistically, but they're receiving the transfer growth. Do y'all see that? And let me tell you the big one that's going to be a hard slap in our face if we don't understand it real soon, and that is transfer growth in this country is already diminishing, and it is going to make a smaller and smaller contribution to the growth of the church in the very near future. It has already started. Now let me go through and show you why this is the case. Most churches depend on any kind of growth on evangelism, but I'm going to tell you, they're going to find a rude awakening. The large urban churches will be the last ones to discover this, you know, because they're running on the transfer growth that you get in these large urban areas. You got to understand, people go through what's called a life cycle. This has been well documented by sociologists like Gribben, Gallup, Roof, and others. Here's what they say. When you look at young people, when they're young, they will have some experience with the church. They'll go to church with their parents or with their grandparents or some sort of contact when they're kids. But about the time they leave home, about 18, they tend to drop out. But as they get married and begin to have children, does this sound familiar? The composite picture? They tend to come back and start looking for a church home because they're concerned about moral and ethical instruction for their kids. Okay, everybody see that one? Now, you've got to understand that this life cycle has served us, but soon will not. Here's how we know. Wade Clark Roof, outstanding sociologist, did a study of baby boomers. Baby boomers, and he discovered 97% of all baby boomers had some church experience growing up. They can follow the life cycle. Everybody with me on that so far? They had some 97% of boomers. And then his study revealed that out of that 97% that had some experience, 33% never stopped going to church, 42% that dropped out and never came back, but 25% did return. That's the 25% that followed the life cycle. But now, here's what has changed. We have already moved beyond the ability to reach the boomers in this life cycle effect because they were born between 1946 and 1964. Their age is 34 to 52. 20 to 39. We don't have many more boomers to reach. Because when they hit 40 and on, the stats didn't tend to indicate they're not that receptive. So now we're left with reaching Generation X. Generation X is half the size of the baby boomers, and they're twice as secular. That is, they have not had the experience of going to church with mom and dad. Most of them have come from broken homes. So they're not going to follow this life cycle effect because they never had the experience in order to encourage them to come back. Now, there's a good news, bad news to this thing. The transfer growth is drying up quickly. Because we're not going to be able to sit around watching Generation X come into our churches. But the good news is, these people are incredibly receptive, and if we will get off our duff and go out after these folks, if we will provide ministry that's meaningful to these folks, they're reachable. They are open. They are spiritually sensitive people. But I'm going to tell you, if we're not willing to bridge this gulf and not willing to make some changes in our churches, you've heard the old saying, we're only a generation away from losing the church. Well, buddy, we have never been closer to the reality than now. If we do not pay the price to reach Generation X, there will not be a strong church tomorrow. That's where we are. And that is going to take evangelism, not just good programs. Okay? I could give you some more research on this, but let me move on and finish this. I know this is a long evening for you. But there's certainly plenty of research in Clear Choices, you can find it there, that will support the claims that I've made about Generation X and their secularity and so forth. All right, the last area we found was the infrastructure. That is the groups that make up the church. Remember me telling you last night, you cannot build a strong church on a dynamic worship service alone. Even though it's the number one variable, it still must be supported by subgroups where people can get together and make meaningful relationships, spiritual bonds with other people, because that is the glue that brings people into, or rather keeps people into the body of Christ. Here's what was found in the research. Growing churches had 6 adult groups for every 100 members, while declining churches only had 4 per 100. And the 6 or 4 are Bible classes, small home groups, ministry teams, if they will work at assimilating new people, any kind of group, recreational teams, it doesn't matter. But it's not just having the groups. Just having the groups does help. It gives more places of entry for new people. But it must be groups willing to go out after people. Let me tell you a couple of instances, true situations. I was describing how a church must develop an effective infrastructure. And we could spend a whole hour, 2 or 3 hours on this one alone. Because you've got to really develop a major infrastructure. And you're going to have to choose between 1 or 3. You're either going to have to choose the Bible class program, Southern Baptist style, period. No other strategy is working. Small home groups that are extroverted and are reaching out to new people. And in some churches have been very effective with using involvement ministry, multiplying ministry teams. Now, a lot more goes in, but you need a basic infrastructure that is well organized, that's goal oriented. All right, so I don't have time to go into all of the ins and outs, but we have training and help you. We can help you in Bible class, we can help you in small groups, and certainly Ray Fullenweiler, you can get over there and get all you need to know about involvement. And let me tell you a true story. I was talking to an elder, and this elder, actually, I was talking about the infrastructure and the need to develop a major ministry for assimilation, and he came up to me and said, "John, let me tell you a true story. We just started a very outgoing greeter program. I mean, we have folks out in the foyer, and I highly recommend this. I mean, we got them out there. You need to use young folks, and we greet, you know, our first-time visitors and greet everyone." A lady came in for the first time, and one of the greeters walked up to her and said, "Hey, we're just delighted that you are here with us. We hope you find this a friendly church." The lady's response, actual words, "I am not looking for a friendly church. I'm looking for a friend." A friend. Now, certainly that she's looking for a friendly church, okay? But the bottom line is, you can only grow to the size in which you can help people connect with your members in terms of relationships. Bottom line. If they cannot connect with other people in your church relationally, they will not stay. This is the honest truth. My wife and I attended a large church in Houston. Won't name the church. She and I attended a Bible class of 30 for 4 Sundays in a row, and not a single soul ever spoke to us one time. I want to tell you, that church has been plateaued for nearly 20 years. And it probably is going to see a period of decline at some point, unless there's major changes in that church's ministry. Folks, these are the 4 most important things. I don't have any stats to establish the Pareto principle, but I believe it's a common sense thing that 20% of your effort will produce 80% of the results. Basically, I think you've got a lot to do, but these ought to be priority number 1. Here's where you should invest the majority of your time, because we know they predict growth or decline. Okay, I'm going to stop. Can I entertain any questions? Ask anything you might like, cover any areas we didn't mention about this study. Yes, sir?
Yes, I was wondering what your other priorities are of the ministers to see themselves of the ones that are in growth. You said that leadership was number 5.
Well, leadership, this is the view. This was just something to express an attitude of ministers. Preachers need an attitude that they are concerned about the whole life of the church, and they're working to help the whole church accomplish its mission goal. No. It's just it's an important issue to help the church. 1, obviously, was preaching. 2 was teaching. And 3 was leadership. You know that. And then right after that, it was evangelism. The growing churches, that's what they saw. Preaching, teaching, leadership, and evangelism. That's what the growing church preacher saw as his top 4 responsibilities. And I can't recall what the 5th one is right off the top of my head. But it's all listed in clear choices. And all of this is further described in detail. Okay, and then the study in measuring church growth of 112 churches basically collaborated our findings here, and then broadened and gave us some additional insights, which we presented last night, and it really is the fundamental tool for you to evaluate your church, and then you would apply the diagnostic why questions when there's problems, and you'll probably find the majority of the whys can be answered right here. Yes, sir? I can tell you this, that the demand for youth ministry is just exploding. Because if you're here, were you here last night? One of the major trends is that people are preferring larger churches. So churches are getting larger, and immediately they're anticipating and wanting quality youth ministry. Plus, not just youth of teens, but a ministry for those preteens, because we're seeing a lot of children's ministry becoming high priority, because remember the cycle, they're coming back, and they're coming back with these young kids they want quality training for. Yes, I'm finding there's far more positions available than what churches, there's available to fill. That's just heartbreaking, really. We're not getting ready for all of the tremendous opportunities. We have more opportunity for ministry than ever before. It's just incredible. It's exciting. But I'm going to tell you, and this is my... Hang on. We're We're focused on 1,000 interesting things other than the mission that God called us to. And all you got to do, well, I think I'll stop on that.
What's the life expectancy of youth ministry? We've done about 3 and 7 years.
Oh, bless your heart. You need to evaluate your ministry then. I'll tell you, I can almost guarantee you what you've been doing is this. You've been having youth ministers that are trying to do it alone. Successful youth ministry is a minister who involves the parents. Long life is there. Doing it alone is burnout track. And what happens when a minister does it alone, the parents don't have buy-in, and the first problem that arises, he's blamed. But when the parents are involved, all right, they have ownership, and they'll deal with constructively the problem. In Church Growth Magazine, we've had Eric Fridge did one of the best articles for us about youth ministry. And buddy, he brought that right home. And if anyone wants to see and get a copy of Eric Fridge's Youth Ministry First Colony, that's it. Yes.
I had a question in regard to the worship you had mentioned about some of the African American congregations that you had experienced.
Right. I unfortunately have not seen many examples, and there are a lot of variables in terms of getting black and white congregations to work together. It's a real challenge.
Because I see that as one of the big draws of some of the major denominations that they're breaking down racial barriers.
And
people are coming together.
Yeah. And everybody's enriched.
Exactly.
Yeah. I tell you what, I wouldn't give anything for the experience I had at Northeast Church of Christ. You ever in Oklahoma City, you go to the Northeast Church of Christ. They brought me in because they were drawing in people by the hundreds. I mean, the building was just packed out. And now they needed an infrastructure, so I helped train them in an area of small groups. That's how they wanted to assimilate all of the growth that they were having. So I find while some of this data I didn't have the stats to include African-American churches. I am learning from what experience I'm having that really it's quite similar in terms of dealing with people is a sociological issue and people have similar needs. And these, I think, would apply in a wide range even though our sample didn't include it. I think you could learn something from it. And we could learn something from each other, too.
Exactly.
Everybody needs to have that experience I had. And find ways. I'm not saying that Anglo churches will ever have assembly worship like that, but we could incorporate. I mean, they did so many things, testimonies, and I mean, they did so many things that involved the people. I mean, people were just loving it. I mean, it was just a wonderful experience.
John, in your research and analysis, has anything come out with regard to the element of quality? The issue that often cloud our ability to move on are really smoke screen and really are diverting us from the fact that
sure. If
not so much what we do, but how well or how poorly we do it, that has a lot to do with our growth.
There are entire books out. Sawchuk has won totally on the issue of quality. Absolutely. Quality is a way to express effective ministry. Oh, absolutely. Quality would be a excellent description of what it takes. Because you have young people out there experiencing quality in every area that they encounter. And when they come to the church, they're expecting the same. Because we all have a consumer mentality. We wear consumer glasses. And we're wanting more and better services from government, schools, businesses, and guess where else? Churches. So quality is a major issue. That's why I say you got to move from a song leader to a worship leader. What's that? That's quality.
Yeah, I was just going to bring that same point up that you brought that up. We come 15 minutes before worship
mm-hmm.
and throw together these songs, and the quality of our worship is very low, and we wonder why people...